This is the BBC third programme, The World and the Observer. In this talk, Bertrand Russell, Order of Merit, proposes a theory which he thinks resolves some of the traditional perplexities about our knowledge of the world.
It is obvious that what we believe ourselves to know about the world is based partly on observation and partly on inference from what we observe. Unfortunately, there are difficulties, both as to observation and as to inference. Physics, for reasons which are substantial, though not demonstrative, leads to the view that material objects are not what they seem, so that observation does not yield quite the kind of certainty that common sense supposes. Inferences from what we observe to what we cannot observe, for instance, the center of the earth or the other side of the moon, are such as to make their conclusions only probable, even when the premises are true and the reasoning correct. I think that the resulting problems should be dealt with by methods more analogous to those of science than to those of philosophy. I propose to offer a theory which seems to me to resolve some traditional perplexities. But I must confess that this theory is personal and has not met with favour from other philosophers, though men of science are more inclined to agree with it. I am, for the present, only endeavouring to state the view, not to give the reasons which have led me to it. I will, however, say this much by way of preface. It is a view which results from a synthesis of four different sciences, namely, physics, physiology, psychology, and mathematical logic. Mathematical logic is used in creating structures having assigned properties out of elements that have much less mathematical smoothness. I reverse the process which has been common in philosophy since Kant. It has been common among philosophers to begin with how we know and proceed afterwards to what we know. I think this is a mistake, because knowing how we know is one small department of knowing what we know. I think it is a mistake for another reason. It tends to give to knowing a cosmic importance which it by no means deserves, and thus prepares the philosophical student for the belief that mind has some kind of supremacy over the non-mental universe, or even that the non-mental universe is nothing but a nightmare dreamt by mind in its unphilosophical moments. This point of view is completely remote from my imaginative picture of the cosmos. I accept without qualification the view that results from astronomy and geology, from which it would appear that there is no evidence of anything mental except in a tiny fragment of space-time, and that the great processes of nebular and stellar evolution proceed according to laws in which mind plays no part. If this initial bias is accepted, it is obviously to theoretical physics that we must first look for an understanding of the major processes in the history of the universe. Unfortunately, theoretical physics no longer speaks with that splendid dogmatic clarity that it enjoyed in the 17th century. Newton works with four fundamental concepts: space, time, matter, and force. All four have been swept into limbo by modern physicists. Space and time, for Newton, were solid, independent things. They have been replaced by space-time, which is not substantial, but only a system of relations. Matter has had to be replaced by series of events. Force, which was the first of the Newtonian concepts to be abandoned, has been replaced by energy, and energy turns out to be indistinguishable from the pale ghost which is all that remains of matter. Cause, which was the philosophical form of what physicists call force, has also become decrepit. I will not admit that it is dead, but it has nothing like the vigour of its earlier days. For all these reasons, what modern physics has to say is somewhat confused. Nevertheless, we are bound to believe it on pain of death. If there were any community which rejected the doctrines of modern physics, physicists employed by hostile governments would have no difficulty in exterminating it. The modern physicist, therefore, enjoys powers far exceeding those of the Inquisition in its palmiest days, and it certainly behoves us to treat its pronouncements with due awe. For my part, I have no doubt that although progressive changes are to be expected in physics, the present doctrines are likely to be nearer to the truth than any rival doctrines now before the world. Science is at no moment quite right, but it is seldom quite wrong, and has, as a rule, a better chance of being right than the theories of the unscientific. It is therefore rational to accept it hypothetically. It is not always realized how exceedingly abstract is the information that theoretical physics has to give. It lays down certain fundamental equations which enable it to deal with the logical structure of events, while leaving it completely unknown what is the intrinsic character of the events that have the structure. We only know the intrinsic character of events when they happen to us. Nothing whatever in theoretical physics enables us to say anything about the intrinsic character of events elsewhere. They may be just like the events that happen to us, or they may be totally different in strictly unimaginable ways. All that physics gives us is certain equations giving abstract properties of their changes. But as to what it is that changes, and what it changes from and to, as to this, physics is silent. The next step is an approximation to perception, but without passing beyond the realm of physics. A photographic plate exposed to a portion of the night sky takes photographs of separate stars. Given similar photographic plates and atmospheric conditions, different photographs of the same portion of the sky will be closely similar. There must, therefore, be some influence, I am using the vaguest word that I can think of, proceeding from the various stars to the various photographic plates. Physicists used to think that this influence consisted of waves, but now they think that it consists of little bundles of energy called photons. They know how fast a photon travels and in what manner it will, on occasion, deviate from a rectilinear path. When it hits a photographic plate, it is transformed into energy of a different kind. Since each separate star gets itself photographed, and since it can be photographed anywhere on a clear night where there is an unimpeded view of the sky, there must be something happening at each place where it can be photographed that is specially connected with it. It follows that the atmosphere at night contains everywhere as many separable events as there are stars that can be photographed there, and each of these separable events must have some kind of individual history connecting it with the star from which it has come. All this follows from the consideration of different photographic plates exposed to the same night sky. Or let us take another illustration. Let us imagine a rich cynic, disgusted by the philistinism of theatre-goers, deciding to have a play performed not before live people, but before a collection of cine cameras. The cine cameras, supposing them all of equal excellence, will produce closely similar records, differing according to the laws of perspective and according to their distance from the stage. This again shows, like the photographic plate, that at each cine camera a complex of events is occurring at each moment, which is closely related to the complex of events occurring on the stage. There is here the same need as before of separable influences proceeding from diverse sources. If, at a given moment, one actor shouts, "Die, varlet!" while another exclaims, "Help, murder!" both will be recorded, and therefore something connected with both must be happening at each cine camera. To take another illustration, suppose that a speech is recorded simultaneously by a number of gramophones. The gramophone records do not in any obvious way resemble the original speech, and yet, by a suitable mechanism, they can be made to produce something exceedingly like it. They must, therefore, have something in common with the speech. But what they have in common can only be expressed in rather abstract language concerning structure. Broadcasting affords an even better illustration of the same process. What intervenes between an orator and a man listening to him on the radio is not, on the face of it, at all similar either to what the orator says or to what the listener hears. Here again, we have a causal chain in which the beginning resembles the end, but the intermediate terms, so far as intrinsic qualities are concerned, appear to be of quite a different kind. What is preserved throughout the causal chain, in this case, as in that of the gramophone record, is a certain approximate constancy of structure. These various processes all belonged purely to physics. We do not suppose that the cine cameras have minds, and we should not suppose so, even if by a little ingenuity on the part of their maker, those in the stalls were made to sneer at the moments when those in the pit applauded. What these physical analogies to perception show is that in most places at most times, if not in all places at all times, a vast assemblage of overlapping events is taking place, and that many of these events at a given place and time are connected by causal chains with an original event which, by a sort of prolific heredity, has produced offspring more or less similar to itself in a vast number of places. What sort of picture of the universe do these considerations invite us to construct? I think the answer must proceed by stages differing as to the degree of analysis that has been effected. For present purposes, I shall content myself by treating as fundamental the notion of event. I conceive each event as occupying a finite amount of space-time and as overlapping with innumerable other events which occupy partially but not wholly the same region of space-time. The mathematician who wishes to operate with point instants can construct them by means of mathematical logic out of assemblages of overlapping events, but that is only for his technical purposes, which, for the moment, we may ignore. The events occurring in any given small region of space-time are not unconnected with events occurring elsewhere. On the contrary, if a photographic plate can photograph a certain star, that is because an event is happening at the photographic plate, which is connected by what we may call heredity with the star in question. The photographic plate, in turn, if it is photographed, is the origin of a fresh progeny. In mathematical physics, which is only interested in exceeding the abstract aspects of the matters with which it deals, these various processes appear as paths by which energy travels. It is because mathematical physics is so abstract that its world seems so different from that of our daily life. But the difference is more apparent than real. Suppose you study population statistics. The people who make up the items are deprived of almost all the characteristics of real people before they are recorded in the census. But in this case, because the process of abstraction has not proceeded very far, we do not find it very difficult to undo it in imagination. But in the case of mathematical physics, the journey back from the abstract to the concrete is long and arduous, and out of sheer weariness, we are tempted to rest by the way and endow some semi-abstraction with a concrete reality which it cannot justly claim. We have seen that for purely physical reasons, events in many different places and times can often be collected into families proceeding from an original progenitor, as the light from a star proceeds from it in all directions. The successive generations in a single branch of such a family have varying degrees of resemblance to each other according to circumstances. The events which constitute the journey of the light from a star to our atmosphere change slowly and little. That is why it is possible to regard them as the voyage of single entities called photons, which may be thought of as persisting. But when the light reaches our atmosphere, a series of continually odder and odder things begins to happen to it. It may be stopped or transformed by mist or cloud. It may hit a sheet of water and be reflected or refracted. It may hit a photographic plate and become a black dot of interest to an astronomer. Finally, it may happen to hit a human eye. When this occurs, the results are very complicated. There are a set of events between the eye and the brain which are studied by the physiologist and which have as little resemblance to the photons in the outer world as radio waves have to the orator's speech. At last, the disturbance in the nerves, which has been traced by the physiologist, reaches the appropriate region in the brain, and then, at last, the man whose brain it is sees the star. People are puzzled because the seeing of the star seems so different from the processes that the physiologist discovers in the optic nerve. And yet it is clear that without these processes the man would not see the star. And so there is supposed to be a gulf between mind and matter, and a mystery which it is held in some degree impious to try to dissipate. I believe, for my part, that there is no greater mystery than there is in the transformation by the radio of electromagnetic waves into sounds. I think the mystery is produced by a wrong conception of the physical world and by a Manichaean fear of degrading the mental world to the level of the supposedly inferior world of matter. The world of which we have been speaking hitherto is entirely an inferred world. We do not perceive the sort of entities that physics talks of. And if it is of such entities that the physical world is composed, then we do not see the eye or the optic nerve. For the eye and the optic nerve, equally, if the physicist is to be believed, consist of the odd hypothetical entities with which the theoretical physicist tries to make us familiar. These entities, however, since they owe their credibility to inference, are only defined to the degree that is necessary to make them fulfill their inferential purpose. It is not necessary to suppose that electrons, protons, neutrons, mesons, photons, and the rest have that sort of simple reality that belongs to immediate objects of experience. They have, at best, the sort of reality that belongs to, say, London. London is a convenient word, but every fact which is stated by using this word could be stated, though more cumbrously, without using it. There is, however, a difference, and an important one, between London and the electrons. We can see the various parts of which London is composed, and indeed the parts are more immediately known to us than the whole. In the case of the electron, we do not perceive it, and we do not perceive anything that we know to be a constituent of it. We know it only as a hypothetical entity fulfilling certain theoretical purposes. So far as theoretical physics is concerned, anything that fulfills these purposes can be taken to be the electron. It may be simple or complex, and, if complex, it may be built out of any components that allow the resultant structure to have the requisite properties. All this applies not only to the inanimate world, but, equally, to the eyes and other sense organs, the nerves and the brain. But our world is not wholly a matter of inference. There are things that we know without asking the opinion of men of science. If you are too hot or too cold, you can be perfectly aware of the fact without asking the physicist what heat and cold consist of. When you see other people's faces, you have an experience which is completely indubitable, but which does not consist of seeing the things which theoretical physicists speak of. You see other people's eyes, and you believe that they see yours. Your own eyes, as visual objects, belong to the inferred part of the world, though the inference is rendered fairly indubitable by mirrors, photographs, and the testimony of your friends. The inference to your own eyes as visual objects is essentially of the same sort as the physicist's inference to electrons, etc. And if you are going to deny validity to the physicist's inferences, you ought also deny that you know you have visible eyes, which is absurd, as Euclid would say. We may give the name data to all the things of which we are aware without inference. They include all our observed sensations, visual, auditory, tactile, and so on. Common sense sees reason to attribute many of these sensations to causes outside our own bodies. It does not believe that the room in which it is sitting ceases to exist when it shuts its eyes or goes to sleep. It does not believe that its wife and children are mere figments of its imagination. In all this we may agree with common sense. But where it goes wrong is in supposing that inanimate objects resemble in their intrinsic qualities the perceptions which they cause. To believe this is as groundless as it would be to suppose that a gramophone record resembles the music that it causes. It is not, however, the difference between the physical world and the world of data that I chiefly wish to emphasize. On the contrary, it is the possibility of much closer resemblance than physics at first sight suggests that I consider it important to bring to light. I think perhaps I can best make my own views clear by comparing them with those of Leibniz. Leibniz thought that the universe consisted of monads, each of which was a little mind and each of which mirrored the universe. They did this mirroring with various degrees of inexactness. The best monads had the least confusion in their picture of the universe. Misled by the Aristotelian subject predicate logic, Leibniz held that monads do not interact, and that the fact of their continuing to mirror the same universe is to be explained by a pre-established harmony. This part of his doctrine is totally unacceptable. It is only through the causal action of the outer world upon us that we reflect the world, insofar as we do reflect it. But there are other aspects of his doctrine which are more in agreement with the theory that I wish to advocate. One of the most important of these is as to space. There are for Leibniz, though he was never quite clear on this point, two kinds of space. There is the space in the private world of each monad, which is the space that the monad can come to know by analyzing and arranging data without assuming anything beyond data. But there is also another kind of space. The monads, Leibniz tells us, reflect the world each from its own point of view, the difference of points of view being analogous to differences of perspective. The arrangement of the whole assemblage of points of view gives us another kind of space, different from that in the private world of each monad. In this public space, each monad occupies a point, or at any rate a very small region. Although in its private world there is a private space, which from its private point of view is immense, the whole of this immensity shrinks into a tiny pinpoint when the monad is placed among other monads. We may call the space in each monad's world of data private space, and the space consisting of the diverse points of view of diverse monads physical space. Insofar as monads correctly mirror the world, the geometrical properties of private space will be analogous to those of physical space. Most of this can be applied with little change to exemplify the theory that I wish to advocate. There is space in the world of my perceptions, and there is space in physics. The whole of the space in my perceptions, for me as for Leibniz, occupies only a tiny region in physical space. There is, however, an important difference between my theory and that of Leibniz, which has to do with a different conception of causality and with consequences of the theory of relativity. I think that space-time order in the physical world is bound up with causation, and this, in turn, with the irreversibility of physical processes. In classical physics, everything was reversible. If you were to start every bit of matter moving backwards with the same velocity as before, the whole history of the universe would unroll itself backwards. Modern physics, starting from the second law of thermodynamics, has abandoned this view, not only in thermodynamics, but also elsewhere. Radioactive atoms disintegrate and do not put themselves together again. Speaking generally, processes in the physical world have a certain direction, which makes a distinction between cause and effect that was absent in classical physics. I think that the space-time order of the physical world involves this directed causality. It is on this ground that I maintain an opinion which all other philosophers find shocking, namely, that people's thoughts are in their heads. The light from a star travels over intervening space and causes a disturbance in the optic nerve, ending in an occurrence in the brain. What I maintain is that the occurrence in the brain is a visual sensation. I maintain, in fact, that the brain consists of thoughts, using thought in its widest sense, as it is used by Descartes. To this people will reply, "Nonsense. I can see a brain through a microscope, and I can see that it does not consist of thoughts, but of matter, just as tables and chairs do." This is a sheer mistake. What you see when you look at a brain through a microscope is part of your private world. It is the effect in you of a long causal process, starting from the brain that you say you are looking at. The brain that you say you are looking at is, no doubt, part of the physical world. But this is not the brain which is a datum in your experience. That brain is a remote effect of the physical brain. And if the location of events in physical space-time is to be effected, as I maintain, by causal relations, then your percept, which comes after events in the eye and the optic nerve leading into the brain, must be located in your brain. I may illustrate how I differ from most philosophers by quoting the title of an article by Mr. H. Hudson in Mind of April 1956. His article is entitled, "Why We Cannot Witness or Observe What Goes On in Our Heads." What I maintain is that we can witness or observe what goes on in our heads, and that we cannot witness or observe anything else at all. We can approach the result by another route. When we were considering the photographic plate which photographs a portion of the starry heavens, we saw that this involves a great multiplicity of occurrences at the photographic plate, namely, at the very least, one for each object that it can photograph. I infer that in every small region of space-time, there is an immense multiplicity of overlapping events, each connected by a causal line to an origin at some earlier time, though usually at a very slightly earlier time. A sensitive instrument, such as a photographic plate, placed anywhere, may be said, in a sense, to perceive the various objects from which these causal lines emanate. We do not use the word perceive, unless the instrument in question is a living brain. But that is because those regions which are inhabited by living brains have certain peculiar relations among the events occurring there. The most important of these is memory. Wherever these peculiar relations exist, we say that there is a percipient. We may define a mind as a collection of events connected with each other by memory chains backwards and forwards. We know about one such collection of events, namely that constituting ourself, more intimately and directly than we know about anything else in the world. In regard to what happens to ourself, we know not only abstract logical structure, but also qualities, by which I mean what characterizes sounds as opposed to colors, or red as opposed to green. This is the sort of thing which we cannot know where the physical world is concerned. There are three key points in the above theory. The first is that the entities that occur in mathematical physics are not part of the stuff of the world, but are constructions composed of events and taken as units for the convenience of the mathematician. The second is that the whole of what we perceive without inference belongs to our private world. In this respect, I agree with Berkeley. The starry heaven that we know in visual sensation is inside us. The external starry heaven that we believe in is inferred. The third point is that the causal lines which enable us to be aware of a diversity of objects, though there are some such lines everywhere, are apt to peter out like rivers in the sand. That is why we do not at all times perceive everything. I do not pretend that the above theory can be proved. What I contend is that, like the theories of physics, it cannot be disproved, and gives an answer to many problems which older theorists have found puzzling. I do not think that any prudent person will claim more than this for any theory.